Our reading this morning is in 1 Samuel chapter 2 at verse 11. 1 Samuel chapter 2 at verse 11. If you can find your Bibles, it's always a good idea. It is on page 272. You remember the situation? Hannah prayed for a boy. She got a boy. But as promised, she gave that boy back to God, and she took the little boy in due course when he was weaned up to the tabernacle and has left him there in the hands of Eli, the high priest. She then had a great prayer that we looked at last week as she prayed herself through that situation of giving her little boy away into this rather evil situation, but trusting him to God. And we pick up the story now, after our prayer, at verse 11. Then Elkanah went home to Ramah, but the boy ministered before the Lord under Eli the priest. Eli's sons were wicked men. They had no regard for the Lord. Now it was the practice of the priest with the people that whenever anyone offered a sacrifice, and while the meat was being boiled, the servant of the priest would come with a three-pronged fork in his hand. He would plunge it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot, and the priest would take for himself whatever the fork brought out. This is how they treated all the Israelites who came to Shiloh. But even before the fat was burned, the servant of the priest would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, "Give the priest some meat to roast. He won't accept boiled meat from you, but only raw." If the man said to him, "Let the fat be burned up first and then take whatever you want," the servant would then answer, "No, hand it over now. If you don't, I'll take it by force." This sin of the young men was very great in the Lord's sight, for they were treating the Lord's offering with contempt. But Samuel was ministering before the Lord, a boy wearing a linen ephod. Each year his mother made him a little robe and took it to him when she went up with her husband to offer the annual sacrifice. Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife, saying, "May the Lord give you children by this woman to take the place of the one she prayed for and gave to the Lord." Then they would go home, and the Lord was gracious to Hannah. She conceived and gave birth to three sons and two daughters. Meanwhile, the boy Samuel grew up in the presence of the Lord. Now Eli was very old, heard about everything his sons were doing to all Israel and how they slept with the women who served at the entrance to the tent of meeting. So he said to them, "Why do you do such things? I hear from all the people about these wicked deeds of yours. No, my sons, it's not good, not a good report that I hear spreading among the Lord's people. If a man sins against another man, God may mediate for him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who will intercede for him?" His sons, however, did not listen to their father's rebuke, for it was the Lord's will to put them to death. And the boy Samuel continued to grow in stature and in favor with the Lord and with men. Amen. A while back, I was standing on the platform in Cross Hill Station, waiting for the train. And just opposite, as you look across the railway line, there's a huge wall of great big block stones. And I noticed that in the cracks between the stones, plants were growing, little flowers flourishing. How can that happen? How in the midst of that great hard stone wall can these wee tiny flowers manage to find enough to grow and to bloom? But there they were, And in some sense, that's an illustration of this particular passage this morning, because it's an awful passage with awful things going on, with the sin of Eli and his priests being explained to us in considerable detail. And yet, throughout the passage, there are the flowers of God's grace seen in the midst of all that darkness. Nothing could extinguish the grace of God. And that has to be a huge encouragement to us this morning in the world that we're now living in, that still the grace of God is able to bloom and able to flourish. We see Samuel, just a wee young lad, flourishing in the midst of such evil and such influence. So there's two things we're going to look at this morning. Just 2 points, ha-ha. 2 points. We'll pretend it's 2 points. 2 big points this morning. First of all, we've got to look in some detail at the sins of Eli and his priests. And then to lift our spirits, we'll look at the incredible grace of God in the midst of that sin. So, just how bad does sin get? Just how bad can it get today? How bad can it get in the church today? Because we need to remember that what we're looking at here was the church of that day. We're looking at the leaders of the church of that day. We're looking at the priests and the sons who led the worship at that time. Just how bad can sin get, even within the church, even here this morning? That's the question we've got to think about. We need to understand that there's an evil out there that wants more than anything else to infiltrate the church, to infiltrate God's people, and more particularly, if possible, to infiltrate the leaders of God's people. This little story this morning surely teaches us more than anything else that there is no sin that Christians cannot commit. There is no sin that a minister cannot commit. We need to understand how vulnerable we are to the power of evil in our world to infiltrate our hearts and our minds. And so we need to look in some detail at the way it's been successful in infiltrating the lives of Eli and his sons. You'll see how it grows. You'll see how it begins so easily. And then its tendrils go out, making the sin grow and deepen in their lives. 4 things we notice about the sins of the priests of evil. Now, these are sins that any Christian can commit. So open your hearts. Pretend there's a mirror there in front of you this morning. And as you look into it, check, is there any of that coming back at me as I look into God's word? First sin that we see in the lives of these young men is that they had no regard for God. That's the first thing we're told about them. Eli's sons were wicked men. They had no regard for God. There it is in verse 12. They're called wicked men. Now it comes as a bit of a shock, I think, to us, because normally when you think of wicked men, you're thinking of Hitler or Stalin or Saddam Hussein or Harold Shipman or people like that, people that have done awful, awful things in their lives. But that's not what's going on here. What's going on here is some young men who had no regard for God, and yet they're called wicked. Men who forgot about God. Men who ignored God. Who put God on the back shelf. Who did their own thing. Who went their own way. no regard for God. And they're called wicked. Now that kind of changes our understanding of people out there this morning. Think of all the nice people you know. Lots of them, isn't there? Really nice. They're very respectable, they're kind, they help you out, they're good neighbours, they're friendly. Good people. But no regard for God in their lives. Never a second thought of God in their lives. Bible says this morning, they're wicked. In God's sight, they're wicked. To have no time for God is wicked. It's quite a challenge, that, isn't it? To think that that's the situation. But it's the start of all that happens in these young men's lives. Anything can happen. The moment you think, I don't need God. I don't want God. I don't even want to think about God. No regard for God. Little story, Jewish story. A little boy was playing hide-and-seek with his friends. And for some unknown reason in the middle of the game, they stopped playing while he was left hiding. He began to cry. His old grandfather came out of the house to see what the bother was. And after learning what was happening, the grandfather said to him, "Don't weep, my child, because the boys didn't come to find you. Perhaps you can learn a lesson from this disappointment. All of life is like a game between God and us. Only it's God who's weeping. We're not playing the game fairly. God is waiting to be found. But many have gone in search of other things." The first sin in these men's lives was they had no regard for God. Second sin we find in their lives is that they have contempt for the gospel. We're looking at verses 13 to 17 here. Inevitably, if you have no time for God, you'll have no time for the gospel. In Old Testament times, the focus of the gospel, the focus of the spiritual hopes of God's people was on the sacrifice. They did something wrong and wanted forgiveness or wanted to get back in fellowship with God. They did it through the sacrifice. And all the different sacrifices were ordered in the book of Leviticus. You can read about them to cover all the possible kinds of sin. You could even think of anybody committing, there was a sacrifice to cover that. Now, of course, all these sacrifices we bundle together and they're fulfilled in the once and for all final sacrifice of Jesus. But that hadn't happened yet. The sacrifices of the Old Testament looked forward to that happening. And it was through Jesus' sacrifice, in back payment, as it were, that they were able to be forgiven. But in those days, if they were going to be forgiven, the sacrifice had to be offered. And it had to be offered properly. If it was not offered properly, it was invalid. It didn't work. Now you see what these young men were doing. They were coming along in the midst of the sacrifice and saying, "I want that bit of meat." Even though it wasn't properly cooked, the fat had not been burned off. The fat was for God. That's what the sacrifice said. The fat alone was for God. They would say, "No, I want it." And they would grab it and they would took it by force. And what was happening was they were nullifying the effect of that sacrifice. People had come wanting forgiveness and they didn't get it. People were coming wanting to get back with God in fellowship and they couldn't get it because the sacrifice was made null and void by these young men in their greed and their forcefulness in the situation. So these young men were in effect showing great contempt for the gospel. That was the result of what they were doing. They weren't just breaking the rules. They were stopping people coming to Jesus, if you like, in modern day terms. They were showing contempt for the gospel. Now, how can that happen in our situation? Well, it can happen quite easy when you do something horrible and you're supposed to be a Christian. And folks look at your life and say, well, if that's a Christian, I'm not going to believe in Jesus. Because your life has shown contempt for the gospel. We have to live lives that support the gospel, that sustain it, that present it. We don't want to live lives that put people off the gospel. But these young men were showing great contempt for the gospel in their lives. And as God's people, if we love Jesus this morning, we need to take every precaution that there's nothing in us that would be showing similar contempt for the gospel of Jesus. Their disregard of God and their contempt for the gospel led to a third aspect of their sin. Because we are told here, particularly in verse 22, that these young men committed open acts of immorality in the tabernacle itself. It's as if they were thumbing their noses at God. We don't care that you can see us. We're going to do it anyway. And they took some of the women and they committed fornication or adultery or whatever with these women in that situation. Now, it goes without saying that in the past 50 years, attitudes to the whole immorality of our nation have hugely changed. When I think how things were like when I was a student at university, Christian student as it happened, I remember us having intense discussions as to when it was right to hold hands with your girlfriend. Now, I don't think anybody would talk about that today. I think there's bigger issues. But that's how it was. Where now anything goes, doesn't it, in the sexual side of things? There's only one sexual sin that society still condemns, and that's paedophilia, when men interfere with children. Apart from that, anything goes. Anything's acceptable, isn't it? And adultery happens within churches. And other sexual sins happen within churches and within church leaders' lives from time to time. We've loosened our whole attitude in this area of immorality. And it comes, it begins when you have no regard for God. It begins when you show contempt for the gospel. Begins when you think you can live without God. So there it is. Three sins. But there is one remaining sin we can detect in the lives of these young men. And in fact, I'm often saying when I'm up preaching, especially when I'm preaching on Old Testament passages, it seems to me it be the commonest sin of all in the whole of the Old Testament. And it's a very simple sin. It's a very easy sin to slip into. It is simply the sin of not listening to God. You see, Eli got wind of what was going on, and give him some credit, he tried. He didn't try hard enough, but he tried. And he did take his sons inside and say, this is not good enough. What he should have done is stripped them of the right to be priests at all. But no, that was too hard for the daddy to do to his nice boys. So he just gave them a wee route. But he did at least try. But you see, it says very specifically, when he did try, it says specifically there in verse 25, his sons, however, did not listen to their father's rebuke. for it was the Lord's will to put them to death. It's not just that they weren't listening to Eli, they weren't listening to God, which is the more serious thing. They closed their ears to what was clearly a word from God. And so that's so often the sin that most of us slip into so easily. God is speaking to us. We know God's speaking to us. We know God's got his finger on something in our lives, but we choose not to listen to it. We choose to ignore it. We choose to do our own thing. We refuse to listen to the speaking of God. He rebukes them. If you don't listen to God, who's going to mediate for you? He says to them, where have you got to go? And there's this horrendous verse, isn't there? This horrendous verse where we're told it was the Lord's will to put them to death. You see, they'd crossed the line. They'd got to that point where God says, that's enough. You're gone. You're dead. As far as I'm concerned, you're dead. And they come under God's judgment. And that's a horrendous place for anyone to come to. When we get to chapter 3, in about 4 or 5 weeks' time, when I come back from a holiday, we'll find an even worse verse. The guilt of Eli's house will never be atoned for by sacrifice or offering. No hope. They've crossed the line. You never want to cross that line. Put yourself outside the possibility of forgiveness. But that's where these young men had gone. Willingly, knowingly, selfishly, as they worked through their disregard of God, their contempt for the gospel, their open immorality, and their refusal to listen to God and his word. Someone wrote this. Some years ago, the Minnesota Crime Commission released a statement more in line with what the Bible teaches about man's basic nature. Every baby starts life as a little savage. He's completely selfish and self-centered. He wants what he wants when he wants it. His bottle, his mother's attention, his playmate's toys, his uncle's watch. Deny him these once and he sees with rage and aggressiveness which would be murderous were he not so helpless. He is, in fact, dirty. He has no moral, no knowledge, no skills. This means that all children, not just certain children, are born delinquent. If permitted to continue in this self-centered world of his infancy, given free rein to his impulsive actions to satisfy his wants, every child would grow up a criminal, a thief, a killer, or a rapist. Now, that's not how we think of children, but there's an element of truth, isn't there? And the reason that doesn't come to be in most children's lives is surely because of the grace of God. Because the grace of God is bigger, greater than the evil that there is in the world today. And so thankfully we can extract ourselves from the murk of the sin of Eli's sons and lift our sights now to gaze on just how amazing is God's grace. Now, of course, what is completely amazing in this section of God's word is the way we see this little boy, little Samuel, somehow or other, not just surviving, but growing spiritually and in all kinds of ways. In the midst of that, in the midst of the worst possible spiritual situation, is beginning to flourish and be developed into the amazing servant of God that Samuel was to become. And so we see the keeping power of the grace of God on his servant in the midst of the most appalling sin. So we discover grace flourishing this morning in the midst of evil. It began in verse 11, did you notice? Then Elkanah went home to Ramah, but the boy ministered before the Lord under Eli the priest. And then when we've been wading her through the murk of Eli's son's sins, verse 18 pops up. But Samuel was ministering before the Lord, a boy wearing a linen ephod. And when we've waded through even more murk in Eli's sons, the portion this morning ends with, and the boy Samuel continued to grow in stature and in favor with the Lord and men. Grace at the beginning, grace in the middle, grace at the end of this whole episode. We see just how amazing the grace of God is. The grace of God stronger than the worst of evil in our world today. The little four-year-old boy being kept safe by the amazing grace of God. Grace, John Bunyan says, can pardon our ungodliness, justify us with Christ's righteousness. It can put the Spirit of Jesus Christ within us, can help us when we're down. It can heal us when we're wounded. It can multiply pardons as we, through frailty, multiply transgressions. Thomas Adams writes, grace comes into the soul as the morning sun into the world. First a dawning, then a light, and at last the sun in his full and excellent brightness. Tozer writes, men may flee from the sunlight to dark and musty caves of the earth, but they cannot put out the sun. So men may in any dispensation despise the grace of God, but cannot extinguish it. The grace of God is infinite, eternal. It has no beginning, so it can have no end. Being an attribute of God, it is boundless as infinitude. Somebody else wrote, our worst days are never so bad that they are beyond the reach of God's grace. And your best days are never so good that you are beyond the need of God's grace. Just how amazing is the grace of God today in the gospel and in Jesus. It flourishes in the midst of evil. Grace also flourishes in the midst of faithful families. And there's that little episode smack in the middle of all the murk of this passage where we're given a glimpse into the lives of Elkanah and Hannah, this faithful family whom God poured into their lives so much grace. For this woman had given her son away to God, and so now she gets three more sons and two daughters given to her. And every year she lovingly stitches a wee bit bigger garment for her son, and every stitch would be soaked in the prayers of this mother. And every year she'd go up and present her wee boy with that lovely, loving gift that she had prepared for him. And we get a glimpse of the power of the grace of God when a family, when there's parents that are given, committed to serving God and to following God. What seemed like a sacrifice is no sacrifice when it's done in service to God. And so this little family, so much blessed because this whole family was given and dedicated to God. And that's such a challenge to the younger couples here this morning who have children or will have children in due course. The power there is when you, as your family, are committed to God. When we went to Korea and our three children were in due course having to go off to Japan and in due course eventually separate from us, school in England, and folks said, you don't do that to children. It's an awful thing to do to children. It's not the right thing to do to children. But it was part of our calling. And we explained to our girls that we were in Korea not as a couple but as a family. We were called as a family to be there. It was a family commitment. And so one night, when they were about to go back off to school to Japan, and they're lying in bed with their mum, and Dave's wife, Esther, was crying because she was going to have to go the next day, and she said, but mum, I just want to take you with me. And Katie was so comforted that she still wanted to go. And years later, when folks challenged her and challenged us and said, was that not an awful thing that you did? Did it not hurt you so much? She says it was fine because my mum and dad cried when we were crying because it was our family commitment to God. And what seems like sacrifice is no sacrifice when it's in him and in his will. God's grace flourishes in faithful families. And finally, we see that God's grace touches every aspect of life. As this little episode this morning ends with this amazing verse, and the boy Samuel continued to grow in stature and in favor with the Lord and with men. And it's the breadth of that that's so lovely. He didn't just grow in his relationship with God. People began to notice, this boy's different. Why is he so nice? How is he coming to be such a lad? And it was because the grace of God was maturing him mentally, emotionally, physically, and spiritually. The grace of God was touching every aspect of his life. And that's what we want for our children, isn't it? We want them to grow up healthy, emotionally, mentally, physically, spiritually. We want that for our children. And that's what was happening to Samuel. Why? Because of the grace of God. There's no other explanation but the grace of God. That's how amazing God's grace is. And it's available every day to every one of us in the dark times and the happy times. The grace of God is available. We need to ask for it. We need to open our hearts for it. We need to say, God, I need that grace today to help me through this dark patch in my life. The amazing grace of God.